You're listening to CFB Hurry Up No Huddle.
Out of the hole to Mesko. Good snap, good hold. And the kick is blocked! Appalachian State has stunned the college football world. One of the greatest upsets in sports history.
Newton, up the middle. No, I'm sorry, goes right. Still loose.
Oh, did he accelerate?
How about
goodness.
Touchdown, Auburn.
Jones lines up in the slot to the right of Solomon. He is back to throw. He is rolling. Looking downfield. Has time to set up. Throws it long. Has a man. It's up for Davis.
Six-yarder. It's got, no, does not have the leg. And Chris Davis takes it in the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my gosh.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game. He ran the missed field goal back.
And now, here's your host.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of CFB Huddle's Hurry Up, No Huddle. Today, I am going to be talking about something a little bit different. I'm going to be talking about the process of recruiting in college football through the lens of the recruitment system in Europe. And to do that, that sounds vague, but to do that, I've brought on a Manchester City writer, I believe from Reed Man City, Mr. Ben Warner. Ben Warner, how you doing, man? All the way out there across the pond in England.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, man, and I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come on here and talk a little sports with us.
Sure.
So the first question that I would like to ask you is, for those who don't understand how the academy system works in for European, well, we call it soccer over here on this side of the pond, but you guys call it football over there. And internationally, it is called football. But how does the academy system work, recruitment and academy system work over there in Europe?
I imagine that it starts much at a much younger age than it does for American football. So for some teams there will be teams as low as under four, like in under, but definitely under seven, things like that. So some players will spend years and years going through the different levels of a club. So they may get picked up very young, playing for, I don't know, their local Saturday team, Sunday team, and then they'll either join sort of a feeder club for one of the bigger clubs like City, or they will go straight to the youth teams there. And there is quite a big turnover in people getting released, but the best players will keep moving up every year, and eventually it gets to be more competitive, more visible, I think. So there's more coverage both from the club as a whole and from and on things like TV, and I'm not sure. And I think I was reading something earlier about the academy system. Yeah, it was something you sent me. It's like an academy, not for American football, obviously, where the people going to it will then go to college afterwards. Well, yeah, we call it university. The academies we have over here, then they're not like that. You could go to university. I imagine it'd be quite difficult to fit it all in, but I'm sure you could. But it's not like that in the same way.
And one of the things that I was genuinely curious about when it comes to these academies is because these youth players, as they're going up through the ranks. They are attending with Manchester City. It's St. Beatty's, I believe, is the academy that these players go to. What's the educational process when they're there? Is it education first? Is it football first? I mean, what's sort of the mindset of these, maybe the rectors or the administrators of these schools?
It is St. Bede, you're right on that one. That's just a regular school that's got a partnership with City. So it started about 4 years ago. So all the academy, all the youth players who come from places like Spain and from other places, Manchester, places like that, they often go to there. So that's where they'll get their actual education, you know, their qualifications, their GCSEs and things. And they have, they have football training sessions there, because that just makes it smoother for them instead of traveling all over the place, getting themselves tired. To it allows them to save energy, improve their skills in a more, I don't know, fluid way. Perhaps I'm not out. Yeah, but for though it depends which perspective you're looking at it from in terms of which is more important. For the actual school, they're more focused on they'll obviously be more focused on getting them the qualifications they need, because they and the club will recognise that there is a large chance that each individual player won't make it. So in that case, they need to have something they can fall back on. But for the club, obviously, they need to make sure that those players are being given the best chance that they can to succeed on the pitch as well as off the pitch.
Now, when it comes to the society, now, on this side of the pond, there is a large discussion really about the function of schooling versus sport. And there was a famous comment by an American football player, because the way it works over here is that these players go through and they'll play high school football, and then that, they hope, leads to a scholarship, which is basically they get everything paid for by the college in return for their services on the football field. And there's varying degrees about how much the scholarship covers and this, that, and the other, which isn't necessarily important. But these high schools essentially function, I guess if I were to compare it to a European level, they're really the feeder programs. They're kind of the EDS, if you will, though they're not directly tied to. Many schools, like there is a high school here in Southern California that sends a lot of their players to one school, one particular university, though they're not necessarily in an agreement with them, and you can't make those agreements. It just tends to be the way that it works. So there's this bit of push and pull on a societal level about the importance of getting that education versus what these kids are there to do in reality. How do you guys navigate that? I guess I could say in Britain or in England and maybe in Europe as a whole, not that I know if you could speak to the larger scale.
Obviously it's changed in more recent years with a greater emphasis on the academic side of things as well as sporting success. In the past, there was very little emphasis from the club on making sure players have something else that they can do if they don't make it, because traditionally there's been very few people making it. Actually, as players, a lot are being shed throughout the different levels. Obviously, it is difficult because some people, if they are convinced they're going to make it that as a player, then they may not focus as hard on their education. But in the same way, there are a lot of players who have not only made it as players, but they've also got fantastic qualifications, like Frank Lampard, who's got 11 GCSEs, I think, including a start in Latin. And Micah Richards, who did A-levels, which is the level above GCSEs, and that's why he was playing for City. So obviously, I mean, it differs from player to player, really.
for those who don't quite understand how the English schooling system work, a GCSE is a...
It's like... okay, so there's... They're the qualifications you'll get at age 16. After that, you've got... It's statutory for you to go to a sixth form or a college and do either A levels or a B tech, and then after that you can go to university and do your degree, and it's taken from there. So, and the place we were talking about earlier, St Bede's, that program is largely for people to get their GCSEs, and then the club then encourage players to go on and get A levels, but it's not mandatory.
So in a sense, it's basically the GCSEs are designed to set up these players, if I'm understanding you correctly, with the requisite skills such that they could seed in the event, in the likely event for many of them, that football sport does not work out.
Everyone gets them. I've got them. I've got no real football talent whatsoever. But everyone gets them. And of course they will be encouraged to go on and try and get more qualifications after that, because that will increase their chance of getting a higher paid job or a more stable income. But yeah, I mean, GCSEs are really the baseline for a lot.
So, and I don't mean to cut you off here. I'm curious. So what then, like, you said that it's changed in recent years, and I find that fascinating, because there's a lot that's changing over here too. And I think that much of that has to do with just the sheer mad money flowing into sport across, you know, really every category. It doesn't matter. Pick which sport it is, and they're just booming. But you mentioned that there was this societal change in maybe how clubs treated the educational process. Was there an impetus for that? Was there an event that happened, or was it just sort of a cultural shift based on maybe political reform or something along those lines?
I think I'd say it's probably the second one. If there has been some sort of trigger, as it were, I can't think of it. I'd say it's just a general shift in society. So towards the more academic roles. In Britain over the last sort of 30 years, we've had a significant decline in the amount of like manual jobs as due to globalization as things go overseas, which makes it more important to have the qualification so you can compete with other people to get jobs working in offices and things like that. But there is just a general consensus of treating youth players better. I've read stories in the past of youth players at clubs in the 70s and 80s and earlier, where they were treated as sort of servants to the senior players, and now it's very much they are regarded as the protégés of the future. So they're treated as well, as you'd expect them to be. They're given the best coaching, the best facilities. They're almost micromanaged in terms of their food intake and their drink intake. It's a much more professional treatment of them now rather than in the past. Presumably in the hopes that it'll mean that more of them do make it onto the pitch as professionals.
Right, I was just about to follow that up and say, I imagine the natural follow-up to that question is how much of that is based out of altruism versus how much of that is based out of the hope for future success?
Wait, do you mean, I assume you mean future success on the field?
Yes, correct. You were saying that you were in hopes that these players are being treated a little bit better, in the hopes that, you know, they're going to produce more down the line. They're viewed as the prodigies for the future. And so that I was asking is how much of this reform is really about that as opposed to, oh, it's the right thing to do, if that makes sense.
I think it's definitely geared towards getting more players into regular playing roles, because you look at the amount of money that clubs like City and a lot of the other English clubs are spending on their youth facilities every year, and it's not a vanity project for them. It's something they really are keen to implement because of the inflated value of players. So it becomes good value for you to be able to produce your own, not just from England, but certainly you've got a lot from places like Spain. And if you can bring them in, integrate them into the culture, integrate them into a squad, then that is better. I mean, better for them because they don't feel out of place, but also good for the team because you can get extremely good talent at a very cheap price. Originally, there will be more cost with equipment and accommodation, things like that, but in the end, it does turn out to be fantastic value.
And I'm curious about that recruitment process because over here it's sort of dog eat dog, and kids, you know, there it starts much younger. I would be lying. I mean, there are some kids where, you know, they get that attention at that early age, but for the most part, they generally wait until about 7, 8, 9 before they start truly exploring. Okay, this kid may be gifted. But the recruitment process, about the time that they hit, you know, for us, it's called high school, about ninth grade, 13, 14 years old. It's starting to trend a bit earlier, maybe seventh, eighth grade now. But that recruitment process is very dogged. It's very rabid. And there cannot be money involved. And I use air quotes when I say cannot, because I'm not sure that those people follow the rules. And yeah. I don't need to explain to you, you know, coming from a football background, about corruption in sports. I think all sports like to have them, especially on the recruiting side of things. What's the recruiting aspect like over there? I mean, is it similar? Is it sort of a dog-eat-dog world where people it's like the Wild West, if that phrase makes sense over there?
I'm not entirely sure how many people you'll have in each age group in, like high school teams, but over here we'll have clubs that will have several different teams for each age group, which allows for a lot more players to be in the club at any one time, which I guess does make it less competitive. In that there's less competition to actually get your foot in the door. Maybe there's more competition to keep your foot in the door year after year and move your way inside. But things like the feeder clubs and the different youth teams, they all allow lots of players to develop their skills all at once, rather than putting your money on a few right to begin with and the risk that none of them come off whatsoever.
Sorry about that. I had myself on mute and couldn't find the unmute button. And so then how... Is there what's the interplay between the potential prospect and the organizations? I mean, do people operate as middlemen to get these kids into the club? I mean, I know that the scouts do their own thing, but I imagine there is here. There are a certain amount of, and we can call them hucksters, you can call them, you know, talent evaluators, who bring those kids to the scouts, you know, like there's a scout for the scout. What's that process like there? How involved are the organizations with the player recruitment as opposed to maybe the scouts and I guess the agents or the parents?
Well, like I mentioned, there's lots of teams that play like on the weekends and they'll train in the evening, things like that. And they'll just be like, they won't be affiliated with the club. They'll just be, you know, something the kids do for fun. Most kids are involved in them regardless of their ability. But the coaches of those teams, through association with other clubs in the area and with professional clubs, will have the connections that if they spot a sort of someone you think, oh, this kid really is good, then they can. Go to one of their contacts who perhaps works at a bigger club, a professional club, and say, you need to send someone down to watch this kid. And then if they do and they like what they see, then they'll negotiate with the parents just to check really that that they're able to make training, things like that, that they can commit to the club. I mean, it's less formal at that age. There's not things like, I've not had much experience with it, but I imagine there's not things like detailed contracts with, there's definitely not wages. But it's less formal, it's more about development at that age rather than it being something potentially to make a living out of. And agents don't come into it for much longer.
Perfect. And just a couple last things here, because I'm curious, are there situations, because here you'll have parents who, say in the state of Alabama, there are two predominant American football universities in Auburn and Alabama. And you grow up in Alabama, your parents are inevitably going to be fans of one or the other. And sometimes, as you can imagine, it's probably say over there, a blue would marry a red, and it just ends up happening. But when the child is going through the recruitment process, I don't know if I think this is a cultural thing here, but parents almost insert themselves forcefully into the discussion of where the child should play, rather than allowing the child to sort of navigate that with the advice of the parent, as you would expect. Is that a commonplace practice over there as well, or are parents much less cynical about these things, much more nurturing?
The parent has what's right for the kid in mind, but also they need to bear in mind what sort of arrangement they can commit to. It'll be them driving the kid to training, however far away that may be. I mean, I've heard stories about parents driving 3 hours twice a week to take their kid training at a professional club, and I think. We've had regulations come into then that prevent that from happening, so that the kid doesn't have to go as far to train with a professional club, and which will not only makes it easier for the parents, but it encourages the child to keep going because they don't have the tedious 3-hour journey twice a week. But
wait a minute, you guys actually legislate for the benefit of the child? Because there are parents here, you say you've heard of parents driving 3 hours just for one professional club. Like, there are parents here who do that once a day. And I'm thinking, wow, that wouldn't fly there, would it?
No. America is a much bigger country, obviously. But it is very difficult on the
lunacy
parents.
Lunacy is the word I would use, lunacy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very difficult on the parents to drive that far because they've got a family life, they've got work, things like that, and it's an unbelievable amount of commitment. So to make it easier on everyone involved, and also to allow smaller professional clubs to pick up good youth players because they're not being snapped up by the top flight clubs further away, then it's a more positive arrangement for everyone. I imagine it's not the government. I imagine it's the Football Association that's put the regulations in place. But it's beneficial for everyone. If the child's encouraged to keep going because it's not so far away, and they're getting professional advice from someone who clearly cares about them. And they may be at a club where they're more appreciated than they would be at a bigger one with lots of other players, then that is likely to increase their chance of succeeding as a professional player, including getting that first professional contract, which is difficult for a lot of players. It's easier for the parents because they're not having to travel as far, they're not having to make as much of a commitment, which means they're less likely to turn around to the child and say, "No, we can't do this anymore. It's too much of a commitment." Which is obviously won't be fair to the child, but it makes sense occasionally because it would be just a huge commitment. And for the clubs, they can get some. It allows smaller clubs to get some fantastic talents that they'd otherwise miss out on.
And just, you know, sort of a last follow-up here to that, and then I want to give you a chance to sort of let people know where they can find your work and what stuff you have upcoming or any social media shouts. But one of the things that I find interesting and almost maybe wishful for you to maybe see some of that trickle in here to the way that we do things is it feels very humane. It to me, it feels like there is a sense of what's best for the club, what's best for the parents, what's best for the child as we sort of navigate the waters of recruitment and growing up an athlete versus over here in America, everybody sort of has their own hand in a pot and they're pushing the kid in this direction, in that direction, and it's sort of a tug and pull. And I guess my last question to you is I'm genuinely curious, and I know that it's obviously a case by case with parents, but I guess I'm just curious, is there any of that over there, or is it what you're basically making it sound like, a much more humane approach to this entire thing?
I mean, obviously there are the parents who are very, very pushy in terms of thinking, no, I know what's best for my child. I'm not going to take what they say into account because they're you know, young, they're immature, and there are parents who always think they know better than the coach. They'll stand on the sidelines of a pitch and shout, "Do this, do that," while the coach's terms are playing an entirely different way. Undermines the training, undermines their confidence if they've always got their parents shouting at them from the sides. But generally, it is more of a kind of experience more focused on developing the child rather than setting them up to be an asset for the club.
Well, you know, it's one of these days, hopefully some of that will trickle in over here. Ben, I know you got a deadline and I don't want to keep you. I thank you so much for taking the time. This is actually really illuminating, and now I definitely want to go do some more research on some of this legislation that takes place, because I think that's a fantastic starting place for exactly what I wanted to look at with academies here in America and the way we sort of run children through recruitment. And I imagine you don't know if you've been any help, but you truly have to me, and I want to say thank you for that. So for those who maybe have further questions or want to follow what you do on Man City, this is your time to tell them about any projects or anything you have going on for you.
If you want to follow some of my stuff, you can follow me on Twitter at Ben_MCR, and I post links to things I write on there.
Right on, my man. Well, once again, I thank you so much for taking a little time out of your day. I hope you get to your deadline, and hopefully tomorrow brings about a similar result in a more progressive fashion against the Reds. So I could stand to do – there won't be penalties, but I could just stand without the up-and-down roller coaster for this one.
Yeah, me too.
All right, Ben, well, you enjoy the rest of your evening, and good luck on your deadline, mate, and thank you so much.
Great, thanks.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another CFB Huddle, Hurry Up, No Huddle. Continuing with my conversations about soccer and college football, today, man, I am pleased to be joined by, well, I mean, he's just sort of Twitter royalty, but Mr. Jerry Hinton, formerly of CBS, I would say you've got your hand in a lot of different things, so I will go ahead and let you tell people what it is you're doing these days. And first of all, welcome, man. How you doing?
I'm doing just great, Josh. I worked for CBS Sports for 5 years, writing mostly college football, the occasional soccer or Olympics post over there. And anyways, I've got a couple of daughters who are under the age of 5, and my wife and I decided last year that we needed a little bit more time for them. And without getting into the specifics, her time is much more valuable than my blogging time. And so I've scaled back, now freelancing, you know, house husbanding, you know, trying doing a little bit of Auburn blogging on the side as well. I grew up an Auburn fan, have returned to the state of Alabama. So Right now, Auburn football, is a big deal. Most of my Twitter account's going to be Auburn related, but I watch a lot of soccer. I watch a lot of basketball, and like you say, I'm doing a lot of things right now. Let's put it that way.
And we were just sort of lamenting, I guess you could call it, before. Now I'll preface this and say that you admittedly are a U.S. guy first, but we were talking about our Dutchness and lamenting the fact that one of these days, and I'm not sure if it's going to happen in our lifetime, but I'm hoping one of these days the Dutch are going to pull this thing through. It was funny. I'm going to open the podcast by asking you a question that we had a circle of journalists all sitting around a table at the Holiday Bowl 2 years ago. And we were trying to come up with of who the college of football equivalent of the Netherlands would be. And the best that we came up with was either Oregon or maybe Wisconsin if you wanted to go the traditional route. A whole lot of maybe New Year's Day success and nothing to show for it. Is that fair? Would you throw anyone else in there?
Yeah, I might say Georgia as well. Georgia, the last time they actually won a national championship was back in, 1980? They've only got the one. So it's been a long time now. It's been 30-plus years. And you look at how many times Georgia has been close to breaking through. We think about the Alabama game a couple of years ago, where clearly if they win that game, I think they beat Notre Dame. The year where they won the SEC, beat Florida State in the Sugar Bowl, one of those odd years where there were actually two undefeated teams playing in the BCS championship game. So they've just had a little bit of luck. They've been like one play away multiple times from really breaking through and getting up to the pinnacle, much the same way the Netherlands has, with their multiple close calls there at the World Cup, and it just hasn't happened. As long as we're considering sort of recent memory, let's say, I think I would go with George there, although I think Oregon also is very good in that they've been, kind of an innovative offensive team that hasn't quite been able to get over the hump, much the same way the Dutch are known for the whole total football thing and having lots of very talented attackers, your Van Persies and Bergkamps and this kind of thing. I could see Oregon there, but, in terms of the, program that you would have expected to have gotten over the hump by now with all the opportunities they've had, I might lean towards Georgia.
You know what? That's actually a really good response. That's not one that we had considered. I think that the problem with it was that we had way too many West Coast guys sitting at that table. so that's probably why we never landed on Georgia. And I want to talk about one of those attackers real quick before we sort of get into some of the fun stuff with college football. I always like to ask fellow Dutchmen this. I read an article by Leander Scharlaken a while back, and I'm sure you're familiar with maybe some of Leander's work.
I am.
But I'd read an article by him a while back about Arjen Robben and sort of saying that, he doesn't like Robben from like a Dutch footballing perspective, because everything that Robben stands for sort of goes against what you really think of when you think of the Dutch style. Like, no doubt he's innovative, but Robben can be entirely selfish and sort of off in his own world sometimes. And because of that, Leander has an issue. He doesn't dislike him, but he just doesn't think that Robben is exemplary of Dutch football. I actually kind of agree with him, although I love Robben. I mean, from a perspective of where Dutch football has been, where it's maybe headed, where do you come down on the Robben train? Because he's a controversial figure among the Dutch.
He is. Clearly the guy is kind of a jerk, but he's a brilliant jerk, and I actually think that kind of fits in with my perception of the Netherlands national program during my lifetime. The first time I can actually remember watching the team was back in 1990. I was, 11 at the time. And since, the listeners missed out on this, we were talking before we started the podcast. My grandparents on my dad's side are born and raised in the Netherlands. So, they're my second team after the U.S. And I remember watching them go out in 1990 when I think Ruud Gullit spit on a German player on the field, if I remember correctly. This was apparently, I later read, you know, after they'd imploded, I think, the 88 Euros or something like that. So, you know, brilliant jerks aren't really an unusual element, let's say, when we're putting together a Dutch national side. So I'm not sure I would necessarily agree with that. Leander knows way more about it than I would. But, you know, at the same time, the last several years, there have been guys who you would say, you know, make it a little bit more difficult to root for the Dutch than you'd like. Your Nigel de Jongs, your Mark Van Bommels, and, you know, these karate kicks to the chest in a World Cup final are not what I would like to associate, you know, the Dutch with. Belarus there, you know, in the match against Portugal, I think in, let's see, 2006. So, you know, they're not all saints on this team, I think it's fair to say. So, you know, Robin, I can deal with Robin. It's really the Youngs that sort of get my dander up, and those are the guys that I kind of wish, yeah, you know, if they were a different nationality, that would have been okay.
Is De Jong sort of like a Gronkowski or a Plumlee in the Netherlands? You know, like they just keep coming out of the woodwork. There's just more and more dudes named De Jong, and you're just like, do they ever stop? And the best part is the last name De Jong is going to give you absolutely no indication as to the guy's color, because you got, not that it necessarily matters, but you got CM, who's whiter than I am, I'm reasonably sure. And then you've got Nigel. And it's like, they've got all these guys on the team named De Jong. And then you're like, are they, somebody asked you, are they all related? And you're like, well, based on the composition of what I'm looking at, I don't think so. I think it's just a popular surname.
I don't know. I would assume it's, you know, maybe it's Johnson translated into Dutch. I would have to do a little bit of research on that.
But let's jump into some of the conversation about college football and soccer. Now, you kind of got excited about even possibly talking tangentially about Leicester. I'm going to do you one better, man. I'm actually just going to go ahead and start with my article before we jump into the academy conversation. And just,
yeah.
You know, I was looking at Leicester, and I'm seeing this run. Now, I want to note that I'm a Man City fan, and things are not going well for City. But I have been on record the whole year as very much enjoying whatever the hell is happening with Leicester. And I keep pulling for these guys. I want them to pull this off. I want this so very badly because of what it could mean, not just for the Premier League, but for sport in general. You know, you got a chance to check out that article, and I'm not trying to get you to, like, praise me or anything like that, but I'm genuinely curious. How dead on would that have been? If Leicester were in college football, would we even be talking about them or pumping them at all?
It would depend a little bit on, I think the best comparison for Leicester would be, you know, a West Kentucky, or to go back a few years to David Carr's Fresno State teams that had won enough in the non-conference to warrant being in that national championship conversation. That's kind of the difficult thing about porting Leicester over and saying, okay, well, what's the college football equivalent, is that it's very tough to come up to a college football equivalent when nobody in college football who has Leicester stature plays Leicester schedule. This is the huge, you know, sort of gulf between these two leagues, let's say, or two, you know, sports. Is that in a system like the Premier League, everybody plays everybody. Everybody plays the exact same schedule. It's a perfect round robin, you know, with those 20 teams. And whereas a team like Houston last year, like that Fresno State team with the Cars, you know, and some of the other Boise State, your other Leicester City equivalents in terms of stature, in terms of prestige, in terms of financial backing especially, you know, they're just not going to have the same scheduling opportunities that Leicester's afforded over there. I do think, though, you would be looking at something like this coming year, like a West Kentucky or Houston that comes out of the gate, maybe beats a couple of main brand programs, gets bumped up near the top of the polls, gets, you know, really lucky, let's say everybody else loses 2 to 3 games, slides into that number 4 spot, in the college football playoff, and then everybody says, oh, well, there's no way they can beat Alabama, there's no way they can beat Ohio State, et cetera, et cetera. And then maybe they pull it off. Like, we're at the stage of the season where that team has basically won the college football playoff semifinal and are now in the championship game. That's where we're at with this Leicester story. And it's, to me, if they pull this off, if they actually win the Premier League, it is the most unlikely thing I would have ever seen in sports. Like, that's the conclusion I've come to, hands down, anything I've ever seen, given, you know, we're talking about an entire Premier League season, 38 games, for them to actually pull it off. I've never seen anything less likely happen in sports in my lifetime.
And it was funny, too, because when I was writing that article about Leicester, I was going through and reading some of the old articles, and, you know, you stumble across I hit across a Mirror article that was really recounting how Leicester stayed afloat. And that's sort of why I opened with that tie where Leicester was like, okay, we are officially not going to get relegated. And that's where this story for me kind of starts. And you look at that, and at the bottom of the Mirror article, it says, is Leicester going to stay in the Premier League after next season? And it was like this overwhelming hell no. And now you flash forward like not even 6 months. And not only are Leicester going to stay in the Premier League, barring just one of the most dramatic collapses we've ever seen in sports history, but it's likely that they're going to be playing with the big boys next season. And that, to me, is so incredibly fascinating. How does a team go from last to first in the richest sports league in the entire world?
It makes no damn sense. Like this, you know, again, some of the research I've done, I've gone back and looked, and in the Premier League era, you know, no newly promoted team, no team that had even been in the second division, you know, the last several years, had done anything like this. The closest equivalent, Ipswich Town, when they joined Premier League in, I think, 2001, ended up finishing fifth, and like 16 points off the top, something like that. Nobody else has even come close to what Leicester's doing. And, you know, again, like you point out, they were done last season. They were relegated. They were dead last with like 10 games to play, and it was over.
And caught up in a racism scandal, too. Let's not forget
exactly
that, 'cause that's like, completely looked over. They were caught up in an awful racism scandal.
Yeah, that happened over the summer. They lost their manager, you know, for this scandal. And it really is something like, you know, a team like the Lakers, right? Not even the Lakers because of, you know, their prestige and their buying power on the free agent market. But, you know, some team that's really struggling, like Orlando. Let's say the Orlando Magic suddenly, like, win, you know, go on a tear, win like 80% of their games to finish this NBA season, and then ended up winning the NBA championship next season. Like, that is completely crazy, but even that is less crazy than what Leicester is doing right now. You know, again, CFB equivalent, it would be like Derek Mason's Vanderbilt team. You know, it showed some light at the end of this past season, winning the SEC championship next year. That's how unlikely this is for them to just flip a switch and go from being the worst team in the Premier League to an almost Champions League lock is, again, I don't really know how to explain it. I don't.
And, well, I mean, I think part of the explanation for me has to start with Ranieri, man, because I look at Ranieri, and Ranieri reminds me of those guys in college who step into really, I like to call them no-lose situations. You know, you're taking over a program that's just been so beaten and miserably battered by the press and by the fans over the past whatever, that there's nowhere to go but up. And expectations, really, for Ranieri, and it's funny, too, because I was listening to a City Watch podcast the other day, and they were talking with the former CEO of Monaco, who had worked with Ranieri. And he was saying, you know, they were sort of talking about the fact that when he was hired, it was the joke. It was a joke around the Premier League. Everybody was having fun at his expense, and they're not anymore. how much life has that man brought to that club, and how underrated do you think he is on a European level as a manager?
Yeah, well, clearly he was underrated when he got there. I don't know how underrated he is right now, considering this is, you know, again, probably the best coaching job certainly I've seen in the sport of soccer.
And I'm curious, when you look at maybe some of the things that Jamie Vardy has accomplished, you mentioned, you know, Boise State or maybe David Carr or Derek Carr and some of the individual stuff that they've done. And certainly whether or not the team is acknowledged is one thing. But if you look at, like, the year that Kellen Moore had his stats, it's hard to even imagine. Well, I mean, they didn't. They brought him out to New York, and that was basically that. And here, Jamie Vardy, Riyad Mahrez, these guys are sitting, you know, in pole position to claim some of soccer's top honors. You know, as you look at the way that we sort of do things in college football from maybe a pool selection standpoint of, oh, this guy warrants consideration or this team warrants consideration, do you maybe think that there's something to be learned from how the Premier League does it? Is there something to be said for being inclusive?
Absolutely. I think, you know, again, it goes back to the scheduling aspect where, you know, we get to see Leicester, by virtue of them just being part of the league, go up against your Manchester Cities. We get to see them go up against your Manchester Uniteds and your Arsenals, and we see, you know, what they are able to accomplish in those big games, and they've been fantastic this year. I don't think anybody's going to forget them ripping City up the way they did a few weeks ago. And that's not the sort of thing we see in college football all that often. Boise State got a couple of cracks at it. Obviously, the 2006 Fiesta Bowl against Oklahoma, you know, is kind of the big David versus Goliath, you know, game in college football's recent history. But they also got to play Georgia. They also got to play Virginia Tech because they were able to maintain that excellence season after season and really kind of turn themselves into a name brand program to some extent. But since they've declined a little bit, we don't have that equivalent. We haven't been able to get those major, you know, matchups in the regular season between the preeminent group of five teams, so-called, and really the big hitters. We have to wait until the postseason when we can get, again, your Houston program under Tom Herman to play Florida State. But by then, it's too late for them to have an actual shot at the national championship. And I'm of the opinion that college football's regular season is so precious and so important that we, you know, eight teams is going to be too many. That's really the tipping point where you lose something from that regular season that's so special. But if there is an argument for it, I think this is one of the major ones, that you open it up and you say, all right, let's give the Houstons, let's give the Boise States, let's give these teams their shot at playing with the big boys and actually winning a national championship. Right now, the path to an actual national championship for these teams is so thin, like the margin for error is so tiny that it's almost not there. And that's really where I think some of the unfairness of college football gets in, that you don't see in soccer and in these overseas leagues. Is there, you know, and even in NCAA basketball, where everybody at least has their conference tournament, they can play their way into the NCAAs, you know, that so many of these teams start the season without any at all realistic shot of having a national championship, that strikes me as a little bit unfair. And I can't go all the way and say, oh, yeah, let's expand the field to eight teams. But I definitely think that's a major argument behind that if you wanted to go in that direction.
Yeah, and more than expanding eight teams, I'm curious if maybe broadening our scheduling requirements or just flat opening some things up. You know, I'm curious where you come down on that, because on the one hand, everybody is going to mention tradition and rivalries. But on the dominant hand, those really haven't been important to the powers that – look, man, when Texas and Texas A&M stopped playing, I officially stopped caring about the tradition argument. If those two aren't going to play anymore, then really what's the point, you know? So I'm curious, if we opened up the scheduling and said, okay, Alabama, you you know, you pick 12 teams, and you have to play X, Y, and Z in the SEC. But then you can pick these teams, and you can schedule up to two group of five. And similarly, maybe we allow the group of five teams to schedule three power five teams to sort of increase their chances at making it, but everybody can play everyone. Is that a wave of the future, if you will? Could that be something that we explore?
Yeah, I think you have to ask ESPN is my initial response to that, you know, because that's the kind of proposal that, you know, is not going to come top down from the NCAA. It's not going to come top down, certainly, from, you know, the Power Five. Alabama is not going to play your Houstons unless there is something very much in it for them. And at this point, I don't think it is. I think it's much more kind of a win-win for the Houstons of the world than it is for Alabama. Like LSU, you know, played West Kentucky last year. It ended up not being an easy game. It ended up being a fairly easy game for them. But at the end of the season, the way, you know, the Hilltoppers were playing, I don't think LSU would have scheduled that game if they'd had, you know, an opportunity to get out of it, let's say. So, you know, it would be kind of up to ESPN, and they would have to say, we think this is in, you know, everybody's best interest to do this, or the NCAA would just have to kind of say, yeah, you know, we're going to give these guys a shot, let them build their playoff resumes a little bit. You know, it's tough to see it happening. Do I wish it would happen? Yeah, I absolutely do. I think something college football could get to would maybe be a little bit of late season, you know, flexible scheduling where we say, okay, we're not going to necessarily play. We don't know who we're going to play in week 13. You know, it'd probably have to be interconference, but if you could do non-conference, kind of a bracket buster type thing where, let's say, in week, you know, 13 or something, we have, you know, each of the top, you know, maybe 20 of the 30 teams in the top 30, according to the playoff committee, happen to just play each other. We know who's going to be at home. We know who's going to be traveling. Do something like that. I think that would be a lot of fun. Again, I kind of think it's a pipe dream at this point. I don't see an easy solution to this problem of, you know, if we're looking for a Lester in college football, how do we, you know, make sure that they're treated as fairly as Lester is? And I'm not sure there's an easy solution to that.
Well, one of the things that certainly we know that Europe definitely does better is their system of recruiting. There seems to be an emphasis here in the States on, and it's important for me to state here that I'm not against education. In fact, I'm all for education. What I'm against is the idea of putting kids in a situation where they're either not interested in an education or the school isn't really interested in giving them an education. And Europe seems to function on a system that primarily focuses on sport with an emphasis on getting these players ready in case sport doesn't succeed. But rather than pretending that education is first and sport is second, but really playing it out vice versa, Europe treats sport as being first and then plays it out like that. Where do you start when you look at our system of recruiting versus how they maybe attack things in Europe? Where do you start to pick things apart with what's wrong with how we go about it?
Yeah, I think my friend Brian Cook writes MGO blog, you know, a popular, very popular Michigan blog, had an interesting suggestion. He said, you know, we have people who major in dance, people who major in art, and they're not necessarily there for the, you know, rounded college experience. They're there, you know, maybe their test scores aren't as high as they might be. I mean, you know, a lot of times they are, but in some cases, you know, they're not. And they're there because they're exceptional dancers. They're there because they're exceptional artists. And, you know, the school says, okay, well, you know, that's fine. And they're allowed to major in dance, major in art. Why can't we necessarily do the same for football players? Why don't we have a football major where you go to school and everybody says, okay, you know, we know, you know, you're not the same necessarily well-rounded student as some of the other members of the student body, but you have a very special talent. You have a very special skill, and we're going to help you develop that skill while you take classes, while you get your degree, all this kind of other stuff. I think something like that might be a start on this side of the pond. Really, the end game, I think, as you point out, it would be some sort of academy type system where, you know, kids, we started to see a little bit of it, like with IMG, where if you are the cream of the crop as far as, you know, football goes. And where the reason you are going to college is not because you're looking to get a degree. It's not really because, you know, you're extremely invested in the engineering program. You're going there because that's the NFL's minor leagues right now. That's the way you get through the NFL is you go play college football. And we know that those people are out there. Clearly, the current system is awesome for a majority of college football players. They're there because they do need the degree. They can use their college football talents, you know, to pay for it. And they come out of there, you know, with everything's great and perfect and all this stuff. We also know that there are a lot of athletes in college football for which, you know, this system doesn't really work the way it ought to be. They, college is getting in the way of, you know, the football career. They need to have everything focused on football. As you point out, the way that, you know, a 16-year-old soccer prodigy in Europe, he's focusing on soccer to start with. That's where his priorities are. And even in this country, we do the same thing for tennis. We do the same thing for gymnastics. We do it for a lot of other sports. And we don't happen to do it for football because these minor leagues are basically, you know, all wrapped up in the collegiate system. And again, that's a great thing for a lot of people. It's not a great thing for everyone. So I do think some reform in that direction would be really nice. And I wonder if that football major or something like it, you know, might be a first step in that direction.
Yeah, I've always been curious why you can get a degree in basically ultimate reality. I mean, I literally in college took a class, an English class around Harry Potter. So you're telling me that that's a perfectly acceptable academic offering, but, you know, we don't want to offer a football degree? Okay, I mean, I guess. But I am curious, you mentioned IMG. IMG, I think, is a fascinating topic of discussion because what they're doing right now, as you mentioned, is probably the closest thing we have in football to the European academy system. There's obviously more in tennis and as you mentioned, in gymnastics. But in football, IMG maybe represents a bit of a conversation for a lot of people moving forward because it really is a juncture. We accept what IMG is, and now the conversation is starting as to whether or not we think that's a good thing. I would argue that it absolutely is a good thing. Should we try and push things more toward the way of IMG? Is that maybe, if you do think that we should, how would we get about saying that this is really the route that we need to go for college football, not just for the kids, but for the parents and the schools?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, the point of this effort, I think we would say, would be to, you know, again, remove some of the hypocrisy from it and, you know, not, again, force some of these kids who, you know, as Shea Patterson, you know, I'm sure he's going to go to Ole Miss. He's going to take his classes. He may even graduate by, you know, before he leaves Ole Miss. But that kid's a football player. Like, the reason he's at IMG is because he's a football player. He's going to be a professional football player, you know, very likely when you've got his kind of talent. And honestly, if you're not doing everything you can to develop a talent like that, you know, then I think it's I don't want to say it's a waste, but, you know, a talent like a Shea Patterson, you know, shouldn't I mean, obviously you want to get your high school education. It can't just be 100% all football all the time, but, you know, I'm not going to blame that kid or his parents or anyone like, you know, them in that situation from trying to make the absolute most they can out of, you know, his God-gifted ability. And so, yeah, I do think, you know, IMG is a good thing. I'm right there with you. I think, you know, my sort of huge, you know, alternate universe plan, I think, might be to look at Europe and say, let's put the onus for developing football players on the professional leagues. Let's have the NFL say, you know what, we're going to open up one academy, you know, for football players in each of our NFL cities. You could even partner it if you wanted to kind of branch out into other sports, like have, you know, the local baseball team, you know, chip in, help build this. And, you know, you could have two sports stars, you know, the local NBA team could get involved. you know, this kind of thing, and maybe have one of those in each of the U.S.'s major cities. And, you know, you would have this academy system where kids could, again, develop athletically as much as, you know, is within reason, and still get, you know, a basic education, focus on that, and then maybe, you know, from there, you know, go straight on, maybe not straight on to the NFL, but into some other developmental league, let them develop, you know, for a couple of years between high school and the pros. I don't know exactly how you would make this work. Clearly, this is, again, kind of pie in the sky. But, you know, I do think we need to move, you know, as a sports society, let's say, in a direction that, again, you know, doesn't saddle your Shea Pattersons with some stuff, you know, at school that maybe isn't in their long or certainly in their immediate best interest for their football career.
Yeah, and, you know, it was when I was talking with Ben Warner of Reedman City, I was asking some of these, I was kind of poking around with him about the academy process there in Europe. And you mentioned some of those parents. And I asked him, I said, how especially in Britain, do they confront that issue? Is that like a chiefly American thing? I mean, he said, you know, to me, his response was fascinating because apparently there was a law there. That they passed that really restricts the amount of travel that parents can do inside of a week in the name of sport. Now, this isn't to harm the kid or anything of that nature. They just don't want parents saying, we are so focused on getting our son to go pro in sport that we're going to start driving him 4 hours each way. You know, a couple times a week. And he said it got really bad here for a while that was happening. And I couldn't help but chuckle. I'm thinking a couple times a week. I know parents that do that 5 times a week. You know, I mean, it's absurd to me that there's a law there that prevents that stuff. And here we almost see it as a sign of good parenting that they do that. And I'm not saying that it's bad parenting, but I'm not convinced that it's good either.
Yeah, well, finding the balance between these two extremes where you say, okay, what is fair to the kid and fair to his or her talent, you know, versus what is too much. And I think a little bit about Gabby Douglas, the gymnast who, you know, won the medals, you know, at the last Olympics is poised for hopefully another big showing in Rio this summer. And I remember hearing this praise for her parents who, you know, she was spotted by this like gymnastics guru. And he said, well, you know, Gabby Douglas, you know, your daughter, you know, talking to her parents, your daughter has an incredible amount of talent. You know, let's put her in this program in Iowa. And I think she's from the Baltimore area, if I'm remembering correctly. You know, let's drag her out to Iowa, put her in this program, and she's going to be so good, you know, and the parents swallowed hard and said, all right, they spent the money, they sent her out to, Iowa, I'm pretty sure is where this program is located, and, you know, everything worked out, and it was kind of provided as an example of, like, here are these parents who are willing to do anything for their kid, and I also couldn't help but think, you know, if she hadn't developed the way she had, if she was merely good enough to like go to the U.S. Olympic trials and couldn't make the team, you know, how would we be viewing this story? So I do think, you know, finding that balance between, you know, okay, I think that program needs to be there for the Gabby Douglases of the world, even in football. I think, again, if you have that kind of talent, you should be able to, you know, do whatever you can to maximize it. At the same time, there are going to be sort of ethical hiccups along the way. Clearly, it's not going to be, even for every kid who has that kind of talent, that kind of lifestyle, that soon is not going to work out. There need to be some checks and balances in place, you know, like, you know, the kind of law you mentioned, you know, there in the UK. But, you know, again, I think we can find those checks. I think, you know, those can be figured out. I think we still need to move forward more in this kind of academy IMG model over the current system. Like I said, that just there's a lot of hypocrisy in it, and I think there's a lot of unfairness in it.
And what's fascinating about the way that the academies work over there, at least for me, is that, you know, we look at the American educational system, and the politics of what are is a completely different discussion and probably podcast, but if you accept the rankings and say, okay, the U.S. educational system is not as good as other countries, and then you sort of say, okay, and this is also how Europe does it, I'm not saying that there is a correlation, but at least at a glance, you look at the academies and say, clearly they're not destroying the European education system. And a lot of footballers, if nothing else, when you hear them speak, they do sound rather educated. They do sound like they've had their schooling. And many times, they're fluent in multiple languages. And you could almost argue that the cultural education they receive is probably more valuable than some of the X's and O's or the ones plus twos that they do. And yet we don't have that same sort of emphasis on cultural education here. If anything, we're kind of in the opposite direction. We're nationalist. Do you think that maybe has something to do with the well-rounded nature of the European educational system, is that they include those other languages and those other cultures?
Sure, I could go for that. At the same time, I do think there's definitely some positives. And if, you know, the negatives were outweighing the positives in the academy system that we see across the pond, I kind of think, you know, they would have made a change. It's been in place for a long time now. Like, this is nothing new. You know, we're talking about decades now over there with this system. And, you know, obviously there are problems. I know particularly with the children of immigrants from, you know, other parts of the globe, from Africa and Asia, there have had to been, again, some checks in place to make sure, you know, there haven't been, you know, cases of kids being exploited. But overall, it seems to work. And I think we can roughly make it work in this country as well. At the same time, again, I go back to David Foster Wallace's essay where he followed, I can't remember the name of the tennis player, but followed him around at, you know, some relatively minor tournament in Canada and kind of talked to him and, you know, followed him from match to match. And, you know, his overall impression of, you know, this guy who was, I think, like 21 at the time, you know, in the world's top 100, was not a huge force at that time. He would go on to, you know, win some, you know, fairly major tournaments, you know, not Grand Slams or anything like that. But this was a kid who had been devoted pretty much exclusively to tennis since the time he was 10 or 11. And it wasn't that he wasn't ill-educated. It was just that he hadn't necessarily acquired a lot of worldly interest. Wallace described him as, you know, a guy who could talk about tennis, but wasn't really comfortable about talking about anything else. And, you know, this is the kind of trade-off I feel like we're talking when we're discussing the educational system within an athletic framework is, you know, is it okay to, you know, develop these athletes into being basically just professionals in their given sport? And, you know, again, I think that's up to the parents. I think that's up to the kid. The important thing is that the option is there. But I do think there are some costs associated, with looking at it, you know, through this European academy, all sports, all the time lens.
And, you know, just one last thing here on the recruiting, and we'll get to some wrap-up. I was fascinated also with how they go about recruiting because, you know, the recruitment process here, it doesn't quite start as early as it does in Europe. I was kind of stunned by some of the answers I was told, you know, 4, 5, 6 years of age for some of these kids. And I guess it makes sense. But it's somewhat fascinating to me that we jump on eighth graders, you know, and it's generally looked as abhorrent by, I'm going to say, at least a decent chunk of the media. You know, there are those who embrace it, but a decent chunk of the media, anytime an interview is done with an eighth grader, people are like, eh, I don't know about that one. But the way that we approach recruiting here versus there, even though they start younger, seems to be way more rabid. And I asked Ben about that, and he said that really when the parents go through the process, for them, he's like, and you'll always have exceptions. You know, he says it's important to remember that it doesn't matter which part of the globe you live in, there are going to be crazy parents. But he said for the most part over here, it's a lot more about the child. It's a lot more about the well-being of the child and what we can do for the child. And I don't sense that over here. You know, here you see instances with recruitment's appearance, like giving visual looks of disappointment when a kid selects. Landon Collins' mom comes to mind. Alex Collins comes to mind, from Arkansas, running in there and jacking the paper off his desk. How do we start going about maybe tempering some of the crazed parents? Because I don't think you do anything about the recruiting until you start with the parents.
Oh, man. it sounds to me, to some extent, about fixing human nature. As you point out, there are going to be parents who are, let's say, over-involved or over-invested, maybe in their kids from the jump. And, I don't know if there's an easy way to solve that. I would say, to make sure that parents are educated about, all the options that are on the table. You mentioned a little bit ago that, in the U.S. and in football in particular, I should just say in football, we kind of blanch a little bit at, eighth graders or ninth graders, beginning to be fawned over in recruiting. And, again, this isn't something that's at all unique. Across the pond, they're signing professional contracts when they're at that age. Even in this country, again, a tennis player, who's, somewhat close to the top level, I can tell you exactly what the top ranked, 13-year-old player in the state of New York would be, or what the number 27th ranked player would be. So, it's a little bit unusual, that we take this approach in football where, everything has to be hands off at that age. I don't really buy that. I think, if a player is clearly that good when he's that young, then he deserves the attention. It doesn't make sense for college coaches who are, being paid to win football games to just pretend, I'm not going to even notice that this one eighth grader happens to be extremely good at the sport of football. I'll just, la-di-da, he doesn't exist. And how that plays into the parents' issue, it just, again, depends on the parents. I wish I had a really good answer for you, Josh, some suggestion. But I think that's just kind of one of these family case by case basis. And in some ways, that's what, this whole issue of the, academies and how do we kind of straighten out, some of the, balance between getting enough football into a football player, life first and foremost, versus that balance. It comes down to a family by family, case by case basis. And I think there are some problems that may just kind of be intractable.
Yeah, I did a study about last summer, about a 2.5-month study. I just, talked to different recruits and different journalists, and I really probed them about just different concepts and different problems facing recruiting. And I was amazed by the amount of intellectual responses that I received as to what the problem was. And then I shifted over to, okay, what do we do about it? And the answers dried up. A pond in the Sahara. They were just gone. Nobody really has any answers. And to be honest, to be fair to the people that I asked, I don't either. It's not like I'm sitting here with a wellspring of answers for how to go about this. We all have the questions, but none of us have the answers yet. So maybe the thing to do is for us to work together to try and find them. Maybe that's the solution here.
It's not going to be – nobody has a magic wand. It's going to be, stuff that comes from the college's end. It's stuff that comes from the NCAA's end. It's stuff that comes from coaches' end. It's stuff that comes from the family's end, the kids' end, the high school coaches. You're absolutely right that, it's going to be a collaborative thing. Recruiting, I think we can all agree, particularly in basketball, is – shady. Let's just put it that way. There are some unethical elements to it, and those need to be stamped out wherever we can. And again, that's part of where I would sort of approve of the sort of let's let the NFL kind of oversee the development more, or at least certainly more than they do now. The development of football players in this country, I think, might get a little bit some of that out of there. But again, that's, a long, long ways off. But again, it's going to take everybody. Any solution is going to have to, you know, come with the approval of every part in the chain, let's say.
Well, a couple rapid-fire, super easy stuff before we let you get out of here. And this is really just because I want to know what the answers are. So we're coming down to the tail end of the Premier League season. Right now, it's looking like nobody wants it, but Leicester wants it the most. Who is going to win this thing? Are they going to be able to hold on? Is Tottenham going to creep in? I mean, is Arsenal going to do the impossible?
I think it's going to be Spurs, honestly. I'm rooting so hard for Leicester. Like, part of this answer, honestly, is that I feel like it would be too painful to really believe that it's going to happen and then not see it happen. So right now my pick is Spurs. I think they've got the best goal differential. Arsenal, if you read the awesome Michael Cayley on Twitter, his expected goals model has been very high on Arsenal, but just – you know, right now, the way Giroud is missing, the way Sanchez is missing, and just kind of doesn't look like his usual self, I don't think they've got enough firepower on front. I think Spurs are a more complete team. We saw that, you know, when they beat City a few weeks ago as well. It's going to be close. I expect it to come down to the final day. I think it should be an amazing run-in, as the phrase goes over there. But I think Spurs is just going to be able to pull it out.
You know, at some point this season, Man City is going to stop being the reference point for success. Like, people are eventually going to realize that that team hasn't beaten anybody that's, like, in the top half of the Premier League. Like, I do not know what is going on, but from a college football standpoint, watching Fresno State for the past, I don't know, four years, it became pretty apparent to me early on that Pellegrini's system or whatever it is he's doing there, it's not jiving. And the team is going backward, both statistically and with what you see on the pitch. And I don't know why they think it's going to get better, but why? It's either a dominant win for City or they get their ass kicked 4-1 by a much better team. And it's just, there is no in between. There are no quality wins for that squad. I'm inclined to agree with you on Tottenham and Leicester, mostly because I think that defensively in the midfield and up top, they've been the most consistent team, teams. And I'm kind of surprised that they've been able. It's insane to me that those two teams have been able to rely on their strikers for the whole of a season. And City, neither City nor Arsenal, Aguero, Rooney, Giroud, like, it's embarrassing, man.
Yeah. Mahrez and Vardy together cost, let me see if I can remember, what was it, 1.4 million euros, 1.7, something like that. So for the combination of Mahrez and Vardy, you could have, like, you know, what, 40 Mahrez and Vardys for one Raheem Sterling, something like that. It's completely insane, but you're absolutely right. Like, you know, Leicester is getting more out of its attackers that, you know, cost it less than $2 million than Arsenal. And, you know, all those other teams are getting almost combined, you know, out of guys who, you know, cost the approximately, you know, GDP of California. So there you go.
All right, and your final two quick hitters are in Europe. Who wins Euro this summer, and who is going to end up taking home the UCL?
Oh, let's see. You have to. I can't pick against Barca for the second one. It's got to be Barcelona. They're just playing, I think, on a different level than everybody right now. You know, Bayern, we just saw them lose over the weekend. I think, you know, Neymar, Suarez, and Messi, it's just, it's ridiculous. I you know, I would like to have some sort of fashionable pick for you there, but I can't do it. As for Euros, man, it's fascinating because this is a wide open field now that, you know, Spain's kind of declined a little bit. You know, again, until I see Germany, you know, not show up for one of these things, I kind of feel driven to pick Germany the way they played at the World Cup a couple of years ago. Spain not quite having the same kind of horses we saw during their great run. And, you know, France and Italy, you know, obviously they're going to be threats kind of scattered throughout the field. But I just don't think anybody has the combination of talent and coaching, especially with Yogi Löw, that Germany has. I hate to pick chalk, for both of these picks, but I just can't go in a different direction on either one. Sorry, Josh.
You know what, though? If there's a sport where you can get away with picking chalk and you'd actually be smart to pick chalk than European football did, you're kind of burning money if you go against it in Europe. Though I will say this. I rode Juventus all the way to the final last year, not just in prediction, but I predicted why they would make the final. And I was pretty proud of that. And I thought they might be able to get it done against Barca just because of continuity and the way that they'd been playing and just the lack of attention on them. And you know what, man? I think they caught Barca off surprise when Morata tied it. But, yeah, once Barca figured out, oh, shit, they're good, then all of a sudden, as you said, they kicked it into a gear. There's not a team that can match right now. I would honestly pick Barcelona to win the World Cup if that were possible.
I think, honestly, the Champions League is the highest level of football that you're going to see. Like, the World Cup is more fun to watch because of the atmosphere and, you know, kind of the national pride at stake and all of that kind of stuff. But the best football you're going to watch, European football, is in the Champions League because those players play together all the time, sometimes all the time over a span of several years. And I think absolutely. Right now, Barcelona is the best soccer team on the planet, hands down, national team, club team, whatever you want to say. It's those guys. They have Neymar, Messi, and Suarez. There, like, end of story.
All right, so I lied. This is my last question because you made it interesting when you put the gauntlet on the table. And I'm going to ask, this is ridiculous. If it were possible, and I don't know how you do this, but if you could find a way to put Barca on a field of play that were somehow level or a sport that both could play with the Golden State Warriors, who wins?
Two swords clashing forever on heaven and earth or something like that. I think right now the Warriors are even better than Barca are. Like, the distance they are outpacing the field is even further than the distance Barca is outpacing the field right now. I have not seen anything like Golden State ever. When Steph Curry, I don't know if you saw the graph where it had his, three-pointers made. Yeah. And, like, you know, he's so far beyond the bounds of what anybody else has done before. It's completely ridiculous. I think 538 said, in baseball terms, he's on pace for a 100 home run season. That gives you some concept. I still take Golden State over Barca. As great as Barca is right now, Golden State is just on a completely another plane.
Well, man, this has been probably one of the most fun conversations that I didn't really want to stop. And we need to, but we will find a way to continue this some other date. What I want to do right now is give you a chance to let people know where they can find you, anything that you have upcoming, or any shout-outs or – I don't know, man. Bills get paid by odd people, and I like to give everyone the chance to acknowledge those that pay their bills.
Exactly. Well, I'm not actually getting paid at the moment, as I mentioned. But you can find my stuff, at Jerry Hinnon on Twitter is where, most of my thoughts go right now. The freelancing thing is not gotten rolling as of yet, still adjusting, to the new kind of house husband role. But hopefully there'll be some things down the pipe soon. And I do write occasionally right now at the War Eagle Reader. The WarEagleReader.com has been my home for Auburn stuff for a while. You know, I haven't been contributing very regularly there while I was working for CBS, but I should have some stuff up there in the fairly near future. Auburn basketball, Auburn spring camp once that gets going. So, there's that. Again, otherwise, just put the, announcements coming soon pretty much. But definitely, anybody who's listening, give me a follow on Twitter, especially, March Madness is a good time for it. I try to have some fun there, and especially if you're an SEC football fan, that's going to be most of the content there. So I appreciate you having me on, Josh. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you know, being an SEC guy, you and I will probably have something to discuss come that September there. I hear there's a pretty big game between some team in Alabama and some team in Los Angeles. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll find out exactly how that goes. But let me get some time to get some hope in I don't know, dreams underneath my belt, and we can have a conversation about how that game's going to go. Jerry, thank you so much, man. It has been my pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the future, man.
Absolutely, Josh. Anytime.
All right. Thanks, man. And we will catch you next time here on CFB Huddle. Hurry up, no huddle. I am Josh Webb. You can follow me on Twitter at FightOnTwist. And you can also follow our publisher on Twitter at KenSing45. That's KenSing45. Kyle KenSing on Twitter. Thanks so much, and we will catch you next time here on College Football Huddle.